Hello and welcome to the Master of Demon Gorge podcast. Today we're talking about the journey to the West. So I recently reread Journey to the West. I first read it when I was 11 or 12. Naturally, reading it again at a much older age, I found that I had not only forgotten entire episodes, but had different and new thoughts made possible by time, and obviously all the additional experiences I've had in between. Besides, of course, other books and ideas that I've come across in the meantime. But obviously, before I can get into any of that, we have to set the baseline. What is Journey to the West? Who wrote it? Etc., etc. Put simply, Journey to the West is one of the greatest works of prose fiction in Chinese literature. Since the 17th century, it has been regarded as one of the four astonishing books of Chinese fiction. The late Professor Jonathan Spence, in his book The Search for Modern China, compared Journey to the West to Don Quixote by Miguel de Cervantes. Among Chinese classic novels, it is one of the most accessible to Western readers and audiences, which perhaps explains why there have been many international adaptations besides Chinese ones. The most recent one, The Monkey King, starring Jimmy O Yang, came out on Netflix earlier this year. And perhaps you're generally familiar with the basic story from any or all of these adaptations. In broad outline, the story is as follows. The Monkey King, later called Sun Wukong, studies magic and the immortal ways and becomes very powerful. Then he rebels against the gods in heaven. When all the Taoist deities of China cannot defeat him, Lord Buddha from India overpowers him and traps him under a mountain. 500 years go by, and it is now the early Tang Dynasty in China. The monk Xuanzang, the fictionalized version of the real historical figure, sets out to travel to India to bring back Buddhist sutras to help to spread Buddhism. On the way, because this was the Buddha's plan, he comes across the trapped Sun Wukong and frees him, on condition that Sun Wukong now has to protect him as he tries to get to India. Xuanzang and Sun Wukong pick up two other demons made good on the way, the pig-human hybrid Zhu Bajie, and the terrifying-looking monk Sha Wujing. Like Sun Wukong, these two have to help Xuanzang get to India in order to atone for their sins. They encounter many other demons and dangers along the way. But Sun Wukong always manages to fight them off, sometimes helped by Zhu Bajie and Sha Wujing, and often helped by various Chinese deities, as well as bodhisattvas and even the Buddha himself, whose will it was for them to go on this quest in the first place. After 14 years, they make it to India, get the sutras, and bring them back to China. For their labors, they're rewarded by the gods, their earlier transgressions forgiven. This story is more accessible to an international audience for several obvious reasons. The Monkey King is cute, so is Zhu Bajie the pig, and they're both funny. The adventures they go on are picaresque in nature. This is the basis of Professor Spence's comparison with Don Quixote. And compared with other great novels of Chinese literature, Journey to the West has a limited core cast, just the aforementioned quartet. And the horse, if you want to count him, the horse Xuanzang rides is actually a dragon transformed into a horse, and sometimes he functions as more than a beast of burden, but as a character. In comparison, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms and The Outlaws of the Marsh both feature hundreds of characters. The Dream of the Red Chamber focuses on a single aristocratic household, but it's a big household. And it's not heavy on plot. It's as far away from an adventure story as you can get. Indeed, I like to compare The Dream of the Red Chamber to Proust and his nearly plotless book, In Search of Lost Time. Finally, there's The Plum in the Golden Vase, but that is an R-rated erotic novel, hardly suitable for younger audiences. Journey to the West was written in the second half of the 16th century, probably between the late 1560s and the early 1580s. We know this in part due to the book's publication history, and in part due to what we know about the life of the probable author, identified only in the 20th century as Wu Chengen. I should note here, perhaps, that for a long time, people thought the author was the Taoist priest, Qiu Chuji, who lived during the 12th and 13th centuries, during the complicated time when China was divided between the Song Dynasty in the south and the Jing Empire in the north, later replaced by the Mongol Empire. We did an episode on Qiu Chuji a while back, perhaps you remember. This identification of him as the author of Journey to the West was obviously due to the fact that Qiu Chuji visited Genghis Khan in Afghanistan in the 1220s. And afterward, his disciple put together a travelogue called The Journey to the West by the priest Chang Chun. Chang Chun, meaning forever spring, being Qiu Chuji's priestly name. But this was obviously just a confusion of two books with similar names, since we know for a fact that Qiu's book was a travelogue, not a novel. But so later scholars worked out that this other man, Wu Chengen, was the likely author. Wu was born in 1500 or maybe 1505 or 1506 in the city of Huai'an in what is now the province of Jiangsu. His father loved books, but had abandoned the way of the scholar to become a merchant. But his business made him wealthy enough to have at least one concubine, and Wu was born to the concubine. From an early age, he displayed both intelligence and a keen interest in reading both history and fiction. In particular, he enjoyed reading short stories from the Tang Dynasty. Even when he was still quite young, his intellectual reputation, especially his literary flair, preceded him so that members of the local gentry knew his name. In 1529, Wu Chengen went to study at the academy established by the provincial governor, who liked him very much. And yet, despite his early promise, he kept failing in the imperial civil service exams. Finally, in 1550, he earned a Gongsheng position, which was a variety of the Xiucai degree, the lowest local degree achievable in the examination system. With the degree, he traveled to Beijing in hopes of being selected for a government position. He was not selected. In 1551, he moved to Nanjing to seek another position, and again was unsuccessful. He wound up living in Nanjing for several years and working as a ghostwriter. He eventually got a job working for a county magistrate, but seemed to have gotten along poorly with his boss and quit after some years. And in all these years, he never married and never had children. So he then spent the final decade or so of his life living alone and writing to amuse himself. So we assume that it was during these final years of his life that he wrote Journey to the West, before his death in 1582. And sadly, because he had no children, there was no one to guard his papers for him when he died, leading to these papers being scattered, making later Wu Chengen scholarship more challenging. Okay, so Wu Chengen largely lived a life of disappointment. And he resented the society and bureaucracy that somehow couldn't put a man of his talents to good use. We see this feeling reflected in Journey to the West. In the beginning of the book, the Monkey King, Sun Wukong, learns magical skills and then declares himself the king of Mount Flowers and Fruits, which is where he lives, and is a land of monkeys. Then, like Lucifer in Milton's Paradise Lost, he makes war upon heaven itself. Only, this is the Taoist heaven, or the heaven of Chinese folk religion, not the Christian heaven governed by all that theology. So this heaven, or heavenly palace, is led by the Jade Emperor, the chief god who functions much like the earthly Chinese emperor, a figurehead at the top of a bureaucracy, who wouldn't really know anything if his underlings didn't tell him. But he has lots of underlings, numerous other gods of various sorts, including deities of all the constellations in the sky, and 100,000 heavenly soldiers and generals. So Sun Wukong challenges the authority of heaven. In response, the Jade Emperor sends his 100,000 troops to attack Mount Flowers and Fruits. And they couldn't defeat Sun Wukong. The gods decide to try to reconcile with Sun Wukong and offer him a job in heaven. Sun Wukong accepts only to find out that it's a job in the stables, tending horses, the lowliest position one can hold in heaven. So he rebels again. Ultimately, his rebellion fails when the Buddha intervenes. Yes, this is Chinese religion, so no one thinks there's anything wrong or strange for Buddhist deities and Taoist ones to coexist in the same stories. But Sun Wukong becomes the sort of romantic rebel who still seems heroic and attractive to us, even in failure. In this respect, he is, again, a bit like Lucifer in Paradise Lost, a text that, by the way, is a near contemporary of Journey to the West. Only in the case of Paradise Lost, many scholars have argued that Milton made the devil seem attractive to make the point that we are easily seduced by evil. In contrast, in Journey to the West, we're absolutely supposed to sympathize with and to like Sun Wukong. Of course, after his failed rebellion, Lucifer changed strategies and sought to corrupt God's latest creation, mankind. In contrast, after his failed rebellion, Sun Wukong turns to Buddhism and accepts a path of religious devotion, spending years helping the monk Xuanzang get to India in order to, in a sense, earn his wings. Even so, just as European Romanticism is thought to have come out of Paradise Lost, which gave European literature the figure of a protagonist at war with the world, so the early chapters of Journey to the West gives us a similarly romantic figure ready to take on the entirety of the might of heaven. So, Journey to the West is a complex book with endless avenues of inquiry. Lots of books and PhD dissertations have been written about it. I'm no expert and cannot tell you about all the scholarship. There are just a couple of things that I really thought about upon recent rereading. One is the question of the cultural source of Sun Wukong. Specifically, the long-standing debate over whether he might have been inspired by the monkey god of the Hindu pantheon, Hanuman. The great early 20th century novelist and scholar Lu Xun argued that he was not, that he was a purely Chinese creation. In his History of Chinese Fiction, Lu Xun argued that Sun Wukong was based on Wu Zhiqi, a river deity first attested to in the classic of Mountains and Seas, that ancient treatise on fantastical flora, fauna, and geography. The classic of Mountains and Seas says that there was a beast in the water that liked to cause trouble, and King Yu the Great chained him to the base of a mountain, and the beast was called Wu Zhiqi. A Tang Dynasty short story, quoting earlier sources, spelled out the full story of Wu Zhiqi, explaining that he had the shape of a monkey and lived in the river Huai. This last fact is significant. The myth of Wu Zhiqi largely existed only in one corner of China, where the Huai River ran. And Wu Chang'en, the likely author of Journey to the West, was from this area. So he would have known about the Wu Zhiqi legend, maybe grown up with it. Additionally, earlier versions of the Tale of the Monkey, contained in the Journey to the West, mention that Sun Wukong's sister is this river demon monkey, Wu Zhiqi. So, according to Lu Xun, Sun Wukong is clearly inspired by Wu Zhiqi, an indigenous Chinese deity. Another major 20th century Chinese intellectual disagreed. Hu Shi, whom we've talked about on this podcast, felt that Sun Wukong was more likely to have been inspired by Hanuman, as portrayed in the ancient Indian epic, the Ramayana. Hu Shi pointed out that in the Ramayana, Hanuman has his own kingdom of monkeys, much like Sun Wukong's Mount Flowers and Fruits. And at one point in the Ramayana, Hanuman has to fight the goddess Surasa, the mother of Naga serpents. Surasa swallows Hanuman, which seems to be bad for Hanuman. But then Hanuman uses magic to make his own body expand. He's inside Surasa's stomach, so now she has no choice but to expand with him. Both beings keep growing until they reach gigantic proportions. Then Hanuman suddenly makes himself small again and escapes through Surasa's now enormous mouth. Why am I telling you this story? Because in Journey to the West, on several occasions, Sun Wukong gets swallowed by his enemies. Sometimes it's part of his plan. And typically he proceeds to beat up his enemies from the inside, kicking and punching their internal organs until they beg for mercy. And the way Hanuman protects the protagonist Rama on his quest rather resembles the way Sun Wukong protects Xuanzang on his quest to reach India. As for Lu Xun's theory that Sun Wukong derives from Wu Zhiqi, Hu Shi suggested that Wu Zhiqi itself might have been derived from Hanuman. Lu Xun and Hu Shi left this debate between them unresolved. But starting in the 1980s, some scholars have argued that maybe they were both right. Maybe Wu Chang'en, writing in his study in probably the 1570s, as well as predecessor writers who already wrote about the Sun Wukong legend, knew about both Chinese simian deities like Wu Zhiqi and Hanuman, the Hindu monkey god. And Sun Wukong was a product of both traditions coming together. Finally, one thing about The Journey to the West that I failed to take note of upon first reading, but now I can't stop thinking about, is what happens in chapters 57 and 58. To summarize, Sun Wukong, Xuanzang, etc. run into some bandits. Sun Wukong kills all the bandits. Xuanzang is very upset with him. Remember, their adversaries are usually demons, not mortal men. And Xuanzang points out that It's wrong to take human lives, even if they're bad people. It's certainly not something a Buddhist holy man should be doing. So in his anger with Sun Wukong, Xuanzang tells him to get lost. "I don't want your help anymore," he says. "I release you from my service." And this is actually the second time that Xuanzang has gotten sufficiently upset with Sun Wukong to tell him to leave. Sun Wukong is also upset because he feels he did nothing wrong. So he walks away in a huff and goes to the Bodhisattva to ask if she can help him get back into Xuanzang's good graces. Almost as soon as he leaves, however, another Sun Wukong shows up and attacks Xuanzang, knocking him unconscious before running off. Zhu Bajie and Shao Wujing see this and think Sun Wukong has attacked Xuanzang out of anger. They think Sun Wukong must have gone home to mount flowers and fruits. Shao Wujing goes there and finds the second Sun Wukong sitting there. Of course, Shao Wujing has no way of knowing that this is the copy, the double, that the original Sun Wukong is with the Bodhisattva. In any event, long story short, Sun Wukong ends up confronting his double. They go up to heaven for the gods to figure out which one is the genuine article, but the gods can't work it out. The Jade Emperor himself cannot figure it out. They go down to the underworld for the gods of hell to decide who is who. The deity presiding over the underworld in this version is what the Chinese called Dizang Bodhisattva, or in Sanskrit, the Kshiti Garbha. Kshiti Garbha asks his mount, the animal called Di Qing in Chinese, who is supposed to have his ears pressed to the ground and so know all the goings-on on earth. Di Qing says he knows the truth, but he can't say it, not in the underworld. Only the Lord Buddha himself can declare what is really happening. So Sun Wukong and his double go to the Buddha. The Buddha announces that Sun Wukong's double is in fact another magical monkey called the six-eared macaque. Upon being recognized for what he is, the six-eared macaque tries to run, but Sun Wukong turns around and kills him on the spot. After that, Sun Wukong joins Xuanzang again, and they no longer have any major conflicts between them, even though prior to this episode, such conflicts were common. So I kept thinking about this episode because, well, what does it mean? Sun Wukong's encounter with his double made me think of Dostoevsky's novel, The Double. And I started looking for interpretations of this episode others may have put forth. I saw one critic saying that in this episode, Sun Wukong suffers from split personality disorder or dissociative identity disorder. I saw another theory, outlandish to me but surprisingly popular, that actually the Lord Buddha himself plotted to murder Sun Wukong because he was ultimately too rebellious. And this was how he did it. He instigated the six-eared macaque to come and impersonate Sun Wukong. With the Buddha's powers, he could make it so that the other gods couldn't tell the difference. And then, when Sun Wukong and his double finally appeared before the Lord Buddha, the Buddha fingered the original Sun Wukong as the double, at which moment the imposter turned around and killed him. And no one is the wiser. This is why Di Qing in the underworld said he knew the truth but couldn't say it, because to say it would be to accuse the Lord Buddha of premeditated murder. Well, it's a hot take, But Wu Chengen did paint the gods in heaven as a rather incompetent and possibly even corrupt lot. So could he have meant to paint even the Buddha himself as a murderer? I saw another theory. This one I agree with. It's a Jungian interpretation, and I saw it in a doctoral dissertation. Essentially, the double is Sun Wukong's shadow. Put simply, the bad part of his personality. Specifically in the context of the story, the part of him that doesn't want to go on this quest. Jung posited this idea of a shadow that we all have, the negative side of our personality that wants to stop us from growing, from overcoming our psychological issues. A lot of stories are about people overcoming their shadows, even stories you may not think are about that. Consider how often a movie villain at some point says to the hero, "Ah, we are not so different, you and I." Consider how many Bond villains say that to James Bond. Consider how in Empire Strikes Back, Luke Skywalker has that vision in the cave in which he cuts off Vader's head only to find it looks exactly like Luke himself. Movie antagonists are often, on some level, the mirror images of the heroes. So the heroes are, in some sense, fighting their doubles, as Sun Wukong has to fight his double. Once he has defeated his own dark side, he's able to continue and to complete the quest without further conflict with Xuanzang. As for why Di Ting in the underworld refuses to speak the truth, I would argue that this is because the underworld represents a person's unconscious, and the hero cannot confront his shadow only within the recesses of his unconscious self. He must do so in broad daylight, as it were, the same way that a movie hero defeats his antagonist in the grand finale, not in Act 2. The same way Luke Skywalker has a premonition of his final confrontation with Darth Vader in the cave, but in the end, the true confrontation does not take place in the darkness of the cave. Anyway, that's what I think. Journey to the West is a complex text, like I said, open to many different interpretations. This episode certainly is. And on that note, this has been MODG. Thank you very much for listening.